Hello and welcome to the program. This is another podcast for The Diplomat. I'm Luke Hunt and with me is Ron Bevacqua. Ron has written a terrific new book, Building an Inclusive Financial Sector, Microfinance and Market-Led Development in Cambodia. And essentially, it's all about the microfinance industry. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Luke.
Ron, let's just, there's been a lot of talk of late about massive blowouts in microfinance, particularly in Cambodia. Can you run us through it? How did microfinance kick off in Cambodia and where is it today?
Sure. Well, this really began when Cambodia transitioned out of the socialist system at the end of the Cold War. And that whole period of when the UN was here and helping the country transition into the new world. And at the time, a very simple story. Of course, the economy had been devastated. There was a lot of poverty here. Most people were just small-scale farmers. And one way they made extra money was by making palm sugar. You'll see all over Cambodia these tall trees. They're, 10 meters high.
Right.
They'll climb up there and take the juice out, and then they take that juice and boil it down into a molasses, which can then be converted into sugar or used for cooking and things like that. That was how they made extra money. But the equipment that you needed to have to make that sugar cost at that time around $30. Mm-hmm. The problem was no one had $30.
It was about the average wage in those days, right? $30
per month. Per month, right? And if you were a farmer, even, you weren't really trading that much in cash. You were usually often using your rice to buy things, right? So cash was much less common.
And rice was currency.
Rice was currency. And so the thing was, now imagine the all these NGOs come to Cambodia to help people try to address the poverty situation. But the thing is, to help people earn money, they needed to have money. So how do you do this? Now, you can give money away, right? Mm-hmm. And some people were doing that, but there's a limit to how much you can give away. So the idea that came to people's minds is, why don't we lend them $30 so they could buy the equipment to make the palm sugar? And that's how microfinance started. That was the original intention behind microfinance, was people have potential opportunities, especially as the socialist system collapsed and the market economy was growing.
And just to clarify one thing, in those days, microfinancing really was well-intentioned, or was it more profit-driven?
It's a little bit of both, and it always has been. The people who were creating the modern microfinance system in the early 1990s were focused on the idea that if you don't have a financial institution that is sustainable, which is another way of saying profitable, then they can't continue to serve their clients. So you had to create a system where people were paying back on time, and the organization was able to cover its costs so that it can continue to provide service. So
right.
Profitability and sustainability were two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
The question really is, profit to what end, right?
Yeah.
We need enough profit to stay alive and or stay in business and expand. But once you get to a situation where perhaps you're extracting a lot of profit and giving it to your owners, that becomes more questionable. Back in those days, that issue wasn't there. All these microfinance operators were NGOs. There were no owners. There was no profits that could be extracted by owners.
Right. And how has that evolved over the last 20, 30 years? The end of the Cold War, the arrival of UNTAC, which brought a lot of money into the system, a couple of billion dollars. And back then people were screaming about the costs of UNTAC. Now you look back and it was nothing.
Yeah.
There was the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, which I think had a lot to do with putting the brakes on spending in Cambodia and what was happening here.
Mm-hmm.
How has it evolved since then?
If we go back to what the vision of the people who created the modern microfinance movement, the ultimate goal was that microfinance should be part of the financial system, not something separate, held apart. It should be an intrinsic part of the overall financial system. And Cambodia is one of the few countries in the world where this is truly the case. Originally, these were NGOs. The problem with NGOs is that management systems are weak, and access to funding to grow is also weak. So
right.
Around 2000, 2001, the central bank created a framework for these NGOs to convert into microfinance institutions.
Right.
Right. And so these were, like any bank, they were shareholder-owned financial institutions. Now, most of the shareholders were the old NGOs or social investors, but nevertheless, the structure was just like any for-profit financial institution.
Mm-hmm.
And what that did, that licensing system and the security of central bank supervision over these organizations, made it much more comfortable for people to lend to them. People, meaning social investors, but also depositors, individuals like you and me or other Cambodian people who deposit their money there. Because the central bank was supervising a system that was regulated and there was a licensing process, it gave people confidence to provide money to the financial institutions, these MFIs, that then on lend to their clients. So that began the process of moving from pure NGOs into into business, right? And again, the modern microfinance envisioned that microfinance would act just like banks, except their target markets were something different. They were these underserved, usually vulnerable or poor people. Right. So it's what Cambodia has is a continuum. You have NGOs. You have microfinance institutions, you have deposit-taking microfinance institutions, specialized banks, and regular banks. And there are organizations that provide microfinance services along that spectrum. And what's so unique about Cambodia is that you can go from one node in that spectrum all the way up seamlessly. Mm-hmm. In other places, the leap from NGO microfinance to a bank is so great that it almost never happens, and so the NGOs stay NGOs. There's some benefit to that, but you still have those NGOs here, right? Some of them are good, some of them are run poorly, some of them have access to resources, some of them don't. So I wouldn't necessarily say that NGOs are better than for-profit institutions necessarily. It depends on the management. It depends on where the money comes from and what the people who gave that money, the investors and the lenders, want. Right. If even today, the microfinance institutions that have strong socially driven management and or sources of funding that come from social investors pay a lot more attention to impact. They're much more careful in making loans. Some of the MFIs here, some of the big ones now are bought by Asian financial conglomerates. And truthfully, they're interested much more in the profits and the social impact side, less so.
Right.
And so, it isn't necessarily the case that one is better than the other. There are bad NGOs and good NGOs. There are good MFIs and bad MFIs.
And
it depends
banks.
On the management. And banks too. And banks too.
Okay. So we've moved along seamlessly, but there's been a lot of talk of late, a lot of reports. There was a report by the NGO Likido earlier this year. There's been a lot of newspaper coverage that there's something not right with the MFI industry in Cambodia. The numbers of non-performing loans are up. What's gone wrong?
Well, in fact, what has been so interesting and unique about Cambodia is that its non-performing loan rate is really an outlier in the world. Up until now, because of COVID and the disruption of the economy, it has risen, right? But maybe it's risen to 5 or 6%, which in other markets is good.
Right.
Here, normally, it's 1%, 1% non-performance,
right.
Which is no country consistently has 1% non-performance. And it's been extraordinary. And so that has been the reason why the microfinance institutions have been confident to continue lending more.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that, again, it really depends on the institution. Some are more aggressive, some are more careful. It isn't as if you can paint the entire industry with one brush. But there's no doubt that because microfinance has been so successful for so long, and compared to the other major markets in the world that have faced repayment crises, India, Morocco, Bosnia, several countries in Latin America, all these leading markets have had problems in the past.
Right.
Cambodia has never had. Not during the global financial crisis. Not even now, really. I mean, a lot of people thought this year, with the withdrawal of EBA...
Mm-hmm. EBA, of course, being the everything but arms policy, which is behind trade preferences given by the European Unions, and they have recently withdrawn that because of the crackdown on democracy and dissent ahead of the 2018 elections. But
When EBA, what happens is that a lot of daughters in garment factories mm-hmm. are sending money home to their parents to pay off these microfinance loans.
Right.
So when that became questionable, that was already a concern. And now you add COVID on top, which has disrupted the tourism business. A lot of migrants who were sending money back to their parents
have
also
yes.
remittances. And of course, a lot of the garment factories have also closed down because demand has in Europe and US have shrunk. So one would have, you know, I was quite concerned at the beginning of the year that this was going to lead to a major catastrophe.
Was that before COVID or as COVID was evolving?
Well, EVA happened first, right?
And I'm trying to get a handle on, there was a lot of people complaining about the state of the microfinance industry before COVID. And that loans were blowing out and that people were having their land seized, and this has actually multiplied under COVID.
Right. Well, so there was no doubt, again, there have been a lot of aggressive new players in the market, and they're looking for market share. And the best way to get market share in a microfinance market is to lend more.
Right.
Because then you attract people. The problem with microfinance really is that the demand for debt is infinite. And if you are not careful in making loans, people will borrow too much. And you see this not just here. You see this in the United States, in other countries, developed countries as well. When credit is readily available, people borrow too much. It's always that way. So, again, you have some microfinance institutions, some banks that do microfinance services that are pretty cautious about it.
Right.
But some that are not, even some of the old players and some of the new players. It's not like it's one or the other, one brush.
Right.
But with the onset first of EBA, people were worried that that was going to disrupt the ability of many clients to pay back because their daughters no longer had the work in the garment factories to send home. Add to that COVID, with the disruption of so many industries, that also would have thought was going to lead to further crisis in the industry. It hasn't. Now, a little bit, you could say that they've kind of kicked the can down the road. About 10% of loans have been restructured, which means we know you can't pay now, so we'll give you 3 or 6 month grace period, and 6 months from now you start repaying again. So 6 months from now, if the economy restarts, people can again service their debts. If not, then we may see the crisis. But interestingly enough, although the non-performance rates have gone up, not as bad as anyone would have expected. Like I said, the rate that it exists now is what you would normally find as good in most other microfinance markets.
Right.
Now, that's separate from the issue of, are people over-indebted, are people selling land?
Right. I think in your book you were saying that the average NPL or non-performing loan in Cambodia was about $3,000, and that's actually about 10 times more than other countries of equivalent standards?
Well, it's the average loan size, not the non-performing loan. The average loan size is about $3,000, which really is an outlier in the microfinance world. Most microfinance loans are in the $500 to $2,000 range, or maybe three, at the upper end, right? You're dealing mostly with fairly low-income people who have small livelihood activities and farms. A farmer might, for a hectare of land, might need to borrow $1,000 or $1,500 to plant, right?
Okay.
Once you start lending $3,000 and $5,000, it's really, a lot of it's going into consumption. Now, that consumption can be school fees, it can be medical care too, but what you often find here is that that money's being used to renovate the home, to buy gadgets for the home and things like that, non-productive uses.
Right.
These days, the World Bank agency that is in charge of microfinance, which is called the Consultative Group to Assist the Poor, CGAP.
Wonderful name.
They argue these days that financial inclusion, microfinance, is a lot more about adding to purchasing power, providing resilience and opportunity, but not necessarily specifically for business development, which is what the old model was.
Right.
One can argue whether that is a bit of a fudge, because again, people do borrow from these institutions for consumption purposes, for non-productive purposes. So far, though, again, we've been worried about this industry reaching to the point where it becomes a crisis, where people really have borrowed too much.
So you're saying, a lot of people are saying that this industry is already in crisis and that there are many, many, many Cambodians, it's impossible to put a number on it, are also in crisis. You're saying it's not in crisis, however, it might just be around the corner.
Well, it might be the case that right now we're in such a unique period because of the impact that the pandemic has had on livelihoods of a lot of people. Now, again, most microfinance clients are farmers, right? It's their children who work on construction sites, in tourism areas, or in garment factories who are helping repay those loans.
Right.
And when they have it, the farmers are still doing their farming, right? But when their children have their income is reduced because of the decline in economic activity, they're sending less money home to their parents, and that could lead to more people not being able to repay their loans.
Mm-hmm.
For the moment, they've kicked the can down the road by restructuring loans. And so we'll have to see, right? But I have to say the resilience of the industry has been surprising even to me. And I've been pounding the table for a while saying, let's be careful about making these very large loans. Because in order to make those large loans affordable, now you're also stretching the loan term out to 5 years or longer. And there's just no microfinance related business activity that
right.
takes 5 years to gestate. So there's no real justification for it. It's much better to make small loans frequently so you keep an eye on your clients and monitor them well. But really, the profit motive is driving them to make larger loans for longer terms, because then you've pushed that money out the door. You don't have to worry about it, that client for the next 5 years.
Right. Okay. What is different about Cambodia when it comes to microfinancing as opposed to other countries? I mean, with your book, you seem to be saying that it's not necessarily issues with MFI itself. It's not even necessarily issues with the government, the legislation, the whole financial institution and its relationship. And it's not necessarily the way people borrow here, or is it culturally? Is it a cultural issue? What separates Cambodia, and why is Cambodia attracting all this attention in terms of the numbers? There are plenty of stories around about land seizures, that MFIs are lending people too much money deliberately, and where their land is used as collateral and that asset is being seized when mm-hmm. they can't afford to repay. We don't see these sorts of stories coming out of other countries. Why is Cambodia different on this score?
Okay. So there's a few things to unpack here. Generally speaking, the original microfinance methodology, the thing is, the people you were dealing with don't have assets. Most people, when they borrow against an asset. That's what a mortgage is, for example, right?
And MFIs are pretty stringent on that sort of...
Right. Well, so normally, because poor people don't have assets, the original model, the Grameen model, was what they called group solidarity. You lend to a group of five people, and if one of those five can't repay that week, the other four have to cover for them. So it's kind of peer pressure oriented, right?
Right.
No collateral. Now, that works for very small loans. But as people get more mature in their financial mm-hmm. capacity, they don't want to be dependent on other people or have them be dependent on them.
Right. right?
And also, it breaks down as people want more than a $200 loan. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you'll see people moving to individual loans. Now, once you have individual loans, you don't have the same group based collateral system. Right. The group solidarity.
Yeah.
So in a lot of markets, in Cambodia is one, they use land title as collateral. And for the most part, it's been notional. In fact, because the land title is not even hard title. So it's not really title. Right.
Okay.
It's just an application that I've applied for hard title, but I never really got it. But so it was notional. It was just the idea that if the client knows that potentially their land could be taken from them if they can't pay their loan, it gives them a greater incentive to service their debt. Now, why is the non-performing rate here so low? It really is a bit of a mystery. Perhaps some of it is cultural, that people really honor their debts and honor their responsibilities. There are other places where you'd think that'd be the case too. Vietnam has a very high repayment rate also.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say. It could be that the lenders, the microfinance institutions, have a good process of assessing their clients, and so they make good loan decisions too. It's not really that clear. Again, the fear of losing your land also helps a lot,
right?
Also, keep in mind, you've had an economy growing at some of the highest rates in Asia for a long, long time. And so the loan sizes go up, but the economy keeps expanding. Now, of course, total debt relative to GDP is going up, right? But nevertheless, if you combine that with longer loan terms so that the amount you're repaying every week or every month hasn't changed that much,
right.
It's just that you're paying for a longer period of time, the whole system has been geared toward growing but not making it so that people have found it very, very difficult to...
So you're saying that the Cambodian microfinance industry is not in peril, that it's not as bad as a lot of people have been saying?
There's no doubt that there's an over-indebtedness problem in part of the market. No one knows an exact figure about what percentage of clients have borrowed more than they can repay. Some of the statistics would argue in the 10% or maybe a little bit higher than 10% range. More than it should be. No doubt about it.
What should it be? If it was 10%, what should it be?
Well, you should never be lending more than clients can repay. Remember, these are vulnerable people.
Sure, but right? The realities are people do. And when you were talking about the Grameen Bank before, I mean, in those days, the way I remember it, was that you'd probably have a group of five women and it was $200 to buy a cow. Here it's like $3,000-$5,000, and that's enough to buy a hectare of land in the right place. So the whole kind of fundamentals of the industry has completely changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what I mean to say is that even if, let's call it for sake of argument, and there's no statistics that prove it for sure, but let's say 1 in 10 clients has borrowed more than they can really comfortably afford to repay without making major sacrifices,
mm-hmm.
cutting back on food, foregoing medical care, things
schooling.
That kind of stuff happens. And the, you know, the red brick story was that you have people that have borrowed too much, in order to get out from under that, they become basically indentured servants in the brick industry. That was another story that happens.
Right.
Now, keep in mind, there are multiple sources of borrowing, of loans here, right? People borrow from pawn shops and...
Loan sharks
and friends and family and all kinds of other stuff and microfinance. So to pin the blame entirely on microfinance is a little bit strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
People borrow, and they have borrowed. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting about the book is if you go back to the early 90s before microfinance, debt was a major issue, borrowing too much, usually to cover medical care, and then having to sell land in order to repay that those loans. That story was existed, that happened back then. You go back to May Ebihada's study in Takao province in the 1950s,
right,
and that story was there. When there was no microfinance, so all the borrowing was informal and people got in over their head. It's a fact of life that especially people in rural areas, farming is a marginal business activity. And it's very easy for people to get in over their head in debt. In fact, just to go a little bit on, as an aside.
Sure.
There's been great work on the financial systems of Mesopotamia 5,000 years ago.
Yep.
Same story. Farmers would borrow when they need, because they need to borrow, have a lot of money up front to plant. If the crop didn't go well, now they have too much debt to pay off. And mm-hmm. this would lead to indentured servitude. It would lead to slavery, all kinds of other stuff. Back then was the idea of the Jubilee. Right, which was debt forgiveness,
right,
was
okay.
something that was embedded in Mesopotamian systems. Jubilee is actually a word I think that's used in the Bible, in the Old Testament. So there was debt.
So jubilee means to write off debt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know exactly what the word was back in then, right?
Right.
But the idea was, in order to maintain social stability, they understood that compound interest
mm-hmm.
means that debts snowball. And that people can suddenly get in over their heads, and then there was this process of forgiving debts now and again. This is 5,000 years ago, right? But the point is, the story of especially rural people borrowing, and because of the nature of farming and things like that, getting in a place where they've borrowed too much, is a story of human history from the beginning of human history, written human history.
Getting back to the original point, what makes Cambodia unique?
All three, the clients, the microfinance institutions, and the central bank that regulates them, they developed and they grew together. And they've built a system. The microfinance institutions have processes for making loans, which includes analyzing clients' cash flows and et cetera, et cetera. The central bank oversees these activities. The borrowers are they're used to financial services. They've been using them now for nearly 30 years. So, again, it's very hard to paint with one brush. Most microfinance clients borrow what they can afford to repay. They're careful enough. They don't get themselves into too much trouble. Some people do. Some people actually maybe made a mistake. They borrow, then all of a sudden a crop failure, someone gets sick, and now they've had to use the money that they borrowed for one thing to do something else, and they don't have the money to repay. It's all kinds of stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean to say is that in any microfinance market, there's going to be this spectrum again of good microfinance institutions, good lenders, and responsible borrowers, and irresponsible lenders and irresponsible borrowers. So to say that the industry, the microfinance industry in Cambodia, is on the brink of crisis, I think would be an exaggeration. There's no doubt that there is more over-indebted clients than there should be.
Mm-hmm.
It is at this moment not creating a systemic risk in the sector. It needs to be drawn down. There's also evidence that people are selling land to repay loans. What percentage of clients are doing this? No one really knows. it can be blown out of proportion. I'm doing some research now to find those land sellers. And it's not as if they're coming out of the woodwork. We can go into places where there are high levels of microfinance debt as a percentage of the number of people involved.
Right.
And look for land sellers. Go to places where there's high non-performance. Right. One area, there's a district called Mem Mot, which is near the Vietnam border. There was a lot of investment in pepper farms, and the price of pepper collapsed, and a lot of those farmers now can't repay their loans. We're there. We're looking for people that are distressed land sellers. And it's not as if, you know, they're lining up. Right. They're there, but it still seems to be, and there still seems to be that it's more of a needle in a haystack thing than systematic. Okay. Again, the idea, and this is what I really want to get away from, the idea that these MFIs are lending deliberately to force people into being over indebted so they can get the land and resell it. This very conspiratorial thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see any evidence. There is evidence that once someone gets in debt, the lender comes and forces the person to sell, or even says, we'll sell your land, not you. We'll do it.
Right.
We've had stories like that. But again, it's not systematic enough. We find a few of those stories in here and there, rather than it being something that, like, these, some people have been saying that some of the microfinance lenders or banks are some of the biggest landowners in the country because they're foreclosing. We find no evidence of this.
Okay.
It's happening, but it's not happening on a systematic scale, as far as we know.
Okay. I everyone's reluctant to crystal ball gaze, particularly in the COVID-19 pandemic era. However, if there's a banking collapse, there's hundreds of precedents around the world about what governments should do, where they should step in, whether it's Chapter 11 in America, or whether there should be a direct bailout, or whether or not you should just let them sink, whether you should bail out the depositors, the clients, or the people who are heavy indebted. I'm not terribly sure whether microfinance has been through that stage anywhere. What should a government do if a systemic crisis emerges within the microfinance industry?
Well, in the wake of the global financial crisis, there were crises in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. India was one, as I mentioned, several countries in Latin America, Bosnia and Eastern Europe.
This is MFIs, not banking.
The microfinance sector. Yep. No, again, microfinance is a lending methodology.
Right.
And it can be done by a licensed MFI, an NGO, a cooperative, or a bank. It's the financial institution legal structure matters less than the lending methodology.
Okay,
right?
So how should a government deal with that in the time of crisis?
You know, what they did, and you know, a lot, in some places they let the weak ones collapse.
Right.
What you can do.
What happens with the debt in the weak ones? Is that kind of packaged and sold off to another MFI, or do they just like keep the money? I can't imagine anyone saying that. But how do you structurally deal with that?
I think it depended on the place. So sometimes indeed there was, you know, the organization collapsed. So they would probably try to sell what's left of their loan portfolio.
Now, right.
What you'd be doing is you'd be selling it for cents on the dollar. Right?
Okay.
Because there's so much non-performance, you don't expect to get the full loan size back. So you're going to sell it to somebody. Let's say I lent someone $100. They can probably repay 60. So I'm going to sell the portfolio for 60, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But there are many things you could do. The number one thing, so when you have a crisis, right, what happens is that non-performance goes up. You have to write off loans. Non-performance means that someone is not able to service their debt right now. It doesn't mean that they've defaulted permanently. They are behind. Right?
Yep.
It's only when they basically walk away from the loan that you have to write it off. And so when you write it off, okay, on the books of a financial institution, a loan is an asset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So now your assets have gone down. So where do you, now your liabilities, which are your deposits and your loans from your investors and things like that,
right,
those don't go away. Right? So the only way you can offset a decline in your assets on your balance sheet is to eat your capital, your equity. Right?
Right.
So that's how the two things balance. And so what happens normally in any financial crisis anywhere in the world, including the global financial crisis, is that the value of your assets falls and the value of your equity falls. And if it falls to zero, you're basically bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the fastest and easiest way to deal with that problem is to inject capital into the financial institutions so that they have positive equity and they're not bankrupt.
Right.
Right? Then they can claw back some of those loans, restart their operations and try to get back on track. Right.
So if there was a crisis here, if it emerges, we're saying there is no crisis at the moment. However, things are not looking great and it could happen, particularly if COVID continues. And there was a systemic kind of collapse in the system, what you would require is the government here to step in through the National Bank of Cambodia and inject capital, its own capital, into the MFIs, and they would have to play favourites, decide which ones would be saved and which ones would be let go.
Well, okay, so I do want to say, although I have been worried about the potential of an over-indebtedness situation leading to a crisis,
right,
snowballing out of control, and that the withdrawal of EBA and then COVID on top were the perfect storm for this kind of thing to happen,
sure,
and it hasn't happened, makes me want to say that we need to remain cautious. We need to be careful. We need to play fair and make the right lending decisions. Continue to do so and continue to monitoring it. We continue monitoring the industry,
right,
and making sure that the lenders are doing the right thing. But I don't at this moment see a crisis down the road. Now, if there were one, one of the reasons why the National Bank wanted the biggest microfinance institutions sold off to Asian financial conglomerates,
right,
was that their original shareholders were not deep-pocketed, okay? They didn't have the capital to inject in case there was a crisis. Now that some of the MFIs are owned by big banks, I would imagine that the National Bank, the central bank, would expect those banks to inject the capital, not them, not the central bank itself, right? In the U.S., in the global financial crisis, the Fed stepped in and injected capital directly, right? But
right,
here, the microfinance institutions are small relative to their parent organizations, and it would be expected that if there was a crisis where they had to write down a lot of their loans,
mm-hmm,
and that burnt through the equity, their owners will inject the capital. Now, that will lead to a shakeout because not everybody has a deep-pocketed owner, right? The way these microfinance crises work is that a small number of clients say, I give up, I can't pay. And what happens then, this happened in India, right? When a small group does that, everyone else who borrowed says, well, why should I be a chump? They're not paying. I can't afford,
right,
but I won't repay either. And then the default crisis snowballs out of control. That's how it normally works, right?
Right.
It isn't as if all of a sudden 20% of clients at one time say, I'm sorry, I can't repay. It's usually a small group, and that process snowballs out of control. Again, I don't see that happening here now or in the next 6 months or a year. Again, who knows if this COVID crisis continues, things may change. But if it were to happen, I would expect the bigger MFIs or the microfinance deposit-taking institutions or the banks that do microfinance lending, their owners, their shareholders will have to inject capital to keep these organizations liquid and solvent.
Right. Okay. Ron, look, thanks very much. Your book, it's a great read. I do the stats and going back and the way you've structured the writing over the history, mm-hmm, of Cambodia, particularly since the end of colonialism, I think it's a terrific job. It'll be available on Amazon soon, we hope.
Trying to get it there, yes.
Right,
yes.
And published online and in it's out, but it's still
right now it's
days
only
in terms
available
of distribution.
Yeah, right now, yeah, it's only available through the central bank in
that's
in
the National
Cambodia.
Bank of Cambodia,
yes,
right?
The central bank. But I'm trying to find ways to get it online or in Amazon so that others can read it. Really, one of the things I wanted to say about this book is that there are a lot of criticisms of microfinance, and of course there are good players and bad players. That's just how it is in any human endeavor, really. That's why I've been very reluctant to paint the whole industry with one brush. I know great microfinance institutions and great CEOs. I know people that really are just focused on making money.
Right.
But truthfully, microfinance was part of a broader approach to economic development, which basically said, let the private sector lead in poverty reduction. Allow these low-income farmers and small business owners, give them a loan, let them interact with the market, and in their own way, they will find a way to improve their business and earn more income. And truthfully, this is the ideology that markets alone are enough to lift an economy and lift individuals out. Now, it has been a very market-driven approach ever since the IMF and the World Bank came in the early 90s, and that has led to a lot of foreign direct investment, which is why you have the garment industry and all these other things. But the fact is, it has led to a lot of inequality as well, because the least efficient producers in the economy, which are mostly microfinance clients, are the ones that are penalized in pure market transactions. So microfinance really is a part of this idea of market-led economic development, which the flip side to that is that the government's role in addressing poverty, in providing public goods, in ensuring that the distribution of income in the economy is fair, that role has been diminished. right? So one of the things I wanted to bring out in the book is that we can criticize microfinance, and again, there are bad players, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But microfinance is part of the broader idea of private sector-led, market-driven economic development. And the idea that private sector actors acting in their own best interest somehow will create an environment where poor people succeed is really ideology and completely wrong. You do still need the role of the government to provide public goods and ensure that the fruits of the economy are shared fairly.
And on that note, Ron Dedacqua, look, thanks very much for your time. It's a great read. And I hope you're right and that there is no crisis in the MFI industry, because if there is, it could be a doozy.
It could be a doozy indeed. It'll affect a lot of people.
All right. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you.